The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
My name is John H. Oliver. I'm past national commander of the ADBC. I live in Marble Falls, Texas, and I was in the 19th Bomb Group, Army Air Corps. We took the first bunch of B-17s over and lost them all the first day on the ground.
I was a clerk at that point. And Ted, how about you?
I joined the Navy in 1938, went through Great Lakes, and went to Mirror Island and boarded the USS Ramapo, and we towed a dump scow to Midway Island, an oil tanker. We went to the Philippines, and I went aboard the USS Canopus in January 1939. Then we made a trip down to the South Seas, down, I can't remember all the ports, Singapore and Saigon, Haiphong, came up to Hong Kong. We lost a man and two men in the river. They drowned and coming back to off Liberty. And we went up to Shanghai, and from Shanghai we went up to Tsingtao, China. Stayed there all summer. That's where the submarines summered. We done exercise and stuff, and I was on the Canopus. And then in August or September, the USS Pigeon was called down to French Indochina, Saigon, Cameron Bay to check on the French submarine Phoenix, and they couldn't send divers down. Well, when the Pigeon come back, she went aground, and the Canopus salvaged it, and they got it off the ground and went back to Manila in October, I think, of that year, and got down there. And then they sent us back up on the USS Marblehead to Shanghai. From then on, I was a part of the crew of the Pigeon.
The Pigeon. And this is Ted Provost. Oscar, how about you?
I'm Oscar L. Leonard. I enlisted in Vancouver Barracks and Washington. Went to Angel Island. From Angel Island, I went on the U.S. Grant about the middle of 1940. I was assigned to Cregador for my basic training, helped put up the 3-inch guns and the machine gun nest that were later used by the Marines in the war. From Cregador, I was transferred to the port area, went through a basic training in motor repair for airplanes, transferred to Clark Field, was assigned to the 28th Bomb 19th Group. I was at Clark Field when the war started. All our planes were bombed out because MacArthur wouldn't let us take them off and go to Formosa. And then on Christmas Eve, Eve of 1941, we were all made infantry, put on PAM bus lines, and went to Bataan. I spent a week on Bataan, and there was a chance for a group to take a load of dynamite and ammunition down to Mindanao. I was chose to go on that group. The way it was determined was the cut of the cards, and the lowest was the one that got to go. We cut a two of spades, a lucky two of spades. No one could beat it for a lower. Only thing you could have done was got an ace, which would have been called a one. And after the surrender, we got orders. I was up, we were under the orders of General William Sharp in Mindanao when he got orders to either surrender the whole force because Homo wouldn't allow him to just have Cregador, and he had to surrender the whole group. Then we were turned into Malabalay and spent maybe a month or so in Malabalay, and a group of us, supposedly electricians and mechanics and all, were taken to Davao and put on a ship, put up to, and went back to Bilibid, spent a week in Bilibid, and stood at attention at that ship while they loaded 1,500 little boxes of ashes of their ones that had been, the Japanese that had been killed. And then we was on a tow tour in Peru and spent 42 days from Manila to Osaka, Japan. At Osaka, we was put on a train, went to Kawasaki, and I spent most of the time in Kawasaki until just before the great bombing raid of July 25th, where 22 to 25 of our buddies were killed in a bombing raid when we were shipped up to northern part, the copper mines. Mm-hmm. We were at copper mines when Bill Halsey set out and sent 16-inch rifle or gun bullets over our, and he put a, some of the ships put a 5-inch shell right through the smokestack of the factory where they were smeltering the copper. And then after that was the, we were up there only a few days from about the middle of July till the 1st of August, or the 6th of August rather, when the atomic bomb was dropped. And there we were in Hitachi when the surrender was done.
I'm Henry Harlan from hometown in Truman, Arkansas, and enlisted in the Army in January of 41 and went to the Philippines, and we arrived in April 22nd on in 41, and we did a recruit trail there on the island. And we was then was searchlight battery. We had two batteries on Corregidor, A battery, E batteries. And then on the last of November, we got word we were going to move over on Bataan and set up our positions, and also gun batteries with us. And we started moving on Bataan the first or second day of December to set all our positions up. And so we were there with lights and gun positions and G battery and so on, was set up, already set up when the Japanese attacked that area. So that's where we were at the beginning of the war.
John, where was hometown for you?
My hometown, I was born in Crockett, Texas, and I moved to San Antonio, Texas, and I enlisted, volunteered to enlist in the Army Air Corps there.
And there. And Oscar, where was hometown for you?
Well, I was born in Greensboro, North Carolina, and my mother was a northern woman, so when I came school age, she determined that I couldn't go to southern schools. We had to go north, and we went to the area of Black Diamond, Washington, because my father was a coal miner, and there was coal mines in that area. I did my grade school in Washington and my high school in Idaho. Then after the war, I decided to use the GI Bill and went to pharmacy school at Pocatello, Idaho.
Yeah, really.
Became a pharmacist.
Ted, where was home for you before the war?
Before the war, I was born in Henleyville, Pennsylvania, and moved to Ohio, for Uniontown. Then we moved down on a farm at Navarre, Ohio.
Okay.
And I've been there ever since.
Great Depression from 1929 until 1941, when the war started. America was in a deep depression. The jobs were very scarce. A good job was made $4 a day. things were inexpensive, but you couldn't get the money. The jobs were not available. And I think it was mostly psychological. Roosevelt came along and told us the only thing we had to fear was fear itself. And I believe it changed the attitude of America considerably, and war was looming on the horizon. So listening to the news, not listening to it, but reading about it, you knew that eventually we were going to be involved in the European war. We didn't know about the Japanese war, but the higher powers did, and they were in the process of fortifying the Philippine Islands to perhaps prevent a capitulation of the islands and keep an avenue open for battles against Japan. But as that happened, Pearl Harbor changed all that. And when Pearl Harbor came along, my story that I want to tell is not about war or prison camp. It's about a very fortunate, blessed by God individual who missed the horrors of the prison camp of the war. We were in the Manila, sitting in the harbor, loading our equipment to go down to Mindanao to establish a new air base when the war started. Thereby, we missed Bataan. But we had a hairy trip down there towing an old ship that didn't even have an engine in it because they were in the process of building it. And we were towing it with an old Navy tug. And in the hold of our Navy tug, we had 1,000 barrels of aviation gasoline. One tracer bullet is all it would take to obliterated us really well. Fortunately, it didn't happen. We got down to Mindanao. We were on the base there when we were first attacked by fighter planes, and they burned up what they found on the ground there, which wasn't too much. Fortunately for me, I was working away from the main part of the base, loading some bamboo to make a kitchen with, and they flew right over us. You could see their eyeballs to strafe an old B-17 that was sitting on a bank right above us. Well, I missed that one. The next few days, we were still around Mount Del Monte Field, and I went down to the water purification plant to get a water tanker trailer full of water. And I was down there at the creek, which was down on below the cliff that the field was on, when the bombers hit. And the only thing that we got was showered with clay from bombs that hit down there. So that's another one that I missed. And then we fortunately moved away from that area and got down to Lake Pinimaloy, which was a peaceful place. And we were in some tall trees, 200 feet tall, and we thought we were well hidden. Until one morning I worked till about 2 o'clock in the kitchen, helping to grind up an old ram of steer. That's the only way you could eat them, is grind them up. And so I was allowed to sleep late the next morning, and I was over there in a cot, sound asleep. And I was dreaming about German dive bombers, and suddenly woke up and I heard the real thing coming down. And I knew that there was no foxholes around there. I just flopped out of bed and ran to the base of a big tree and stayed there until the raid was over. And a miracle happened here. I was supposed to move into a tent that my friends had in another area nearby. And a bomb hit right in the door of that tent, shredded it into shreds. And the shrapnel was so thick that a guy had a footlocker there with the bolo in the bottom of that footlocker. A piece of shrapnel hit that bolo, which was a knife that the natives used, and bent it into a horseshoe shape. And I would have been in that bunk right there if I hadn't moved the day before. So I missed that. Then we were surrendered by Wainwright because... I don't know if anybody's told you, but they had all the guys on Cregador down on the 92nd Garage area. They would not give them any food or water until we surrendered. Well, Wainwright came on the radio and asked us to surrender. We knew that he was under duress and we weren't going to do it. But 2 days later, they flew a major down with official orders for us to surrender or be classified as deserters. And our CO read these orders to us and, being a good soldier, we followed them, and we capitulated and met the Japanese down on the road. And they took us to a place called Malaybalay, and we were there for 6 months, and they treated us real well. And we didn't quite understand that. We thought it was all going to be like that. But the reason they were doing this, there were a lot of guys out still out in the hills, and they knew through the grapevine that if we were getting treated well, then they were trying to get them to come in. And they did get a few of them to come in, and a few of the others went and joined the guerrillas. But a good number of them died in the jungle because the natives killed them for their weapon. And so we were in Malibu for 6 months, and then we went on a transport up to Manila and changed ships there. And we were 42 days, I believe, on that ship. And the second morning out, they fired two torpedoes at us. But fortunately for us, the old captain had real good lookouts, saw them coming, turned the ship into them, and it went right by the fantail. And they were old torpedoes. Later on, the submariners told us if we'd had the Newport torpedoes, you would have been long gone. And I was right in the bottom of the hole with my head against the boiler room. And somebody else has already told you how they stacked us in there. But it had no chance for escape. We got on to Japan. We worked in Kawasaki in the steel mills there. And then B-29 started coming over in late 44. And they'd come over 200 or 300 at a time at night. They burned down everything around us and hit us two different times with firebombs. But everything we had was in this one building, so we put the fires out. Then about a month before the war was over, they got a group of us to go up to Hitachi, they'd burned down everything around there, and all you could do was clean up work. But they forgot about that. They needed some people that could do some work, so they sent us to Hitachi to a copper smelter. And our camp there was in a narrow valley that had our camp against the mountains and a narrow highway and then the little river. We were there until the first bombers came over and firebombed the city. And then a few nights later, things were heating up out there. We began to see some Navy planes coming off of carriers out there. And then one morning we were getting ready to go to work, and we were all still in camp, and we're in a little building that's probably about, I guess, five times as big as this room. And we slept in double row bunks. We said bunks, it was platforms we slept on, with little thin rice straw mats. And you've heard all the stories about the fleas, the lice, and the predators, and the Japanese, how they treated us. Then one night it was awfully cloudy and fogged over, and we said, well, we'll get to sleep tonight. We had been kept awake all night with the bombers coming over, and had to work the next day, and that wasn't very fun, because we worked about 10 hours. And things were peaceful. We thought we were going to get a good night's sleep, and all of a sudden, all hell broke loose, and explosions everywhere. And we listened for airplanes. We couldn't hear any. The Japanese guards, they got up and put on their damn bayonets on the rifle, looking around and guarding us. And the next round, they all lay down, wondering where the hell's coming from. We looked down towards the beach, which was about 4 miles away, I guess, and we saw these big red flashes. And we knew then that it was a naval attack, and it lasted 55 minutes. The battleship was shelling our area because the radar was picking up the copper in the smelter. It was stacked everywhere. This was in 1945.
In 1939 or 8, when I went in, you couldn't get a job. Kids couldn't get a job. They wanted men, not boys. Then I joined the Navy, and I was in there when the war started. I was out in the Philippines when the war started. There wasn't anything you could do about it. The pigeon of the submarine salvage and rescue vessel, and we took care of the submarines and stuff like that.
Well, along about in 37, I guess, I tried to join the Navy, and I didn't know I was colorblind, and they wouldn't accept you in the Navy if you're colorblind. I didn't think about going into the Army at all, but if you remember, in October of 1940, we had to register for the draft, and on the 1st of January, they called me in for examination. They said, well, you passed. To just notify your employer. I was working at a Singer manufacturing company and we were drawing 30 cents an hour, which was a pretty good job in that part of Arkansas at that time. So rather than face the draft, I volunteered for the Army.
And Oscar, how about you?
Well, I always was lucky. I always had work. I was up in northern Idaho, and I was working for a fella that was a Gippo logger. And that was early days, and all cross-cut saws were manual, and the horse did the work. So this fella kept me in work in the summer. I got $45 a month in beans. Then in the wintertime, I took care of the horses and went to high school. Graduated from high school in 39. I was talked into joining the 116th Cavalry of the National Guard, and it was a horse-drawn outfit, and we had a good outfit that practiced with the 45s shooting from the horses and all. It was a good deal. But my father had been in the cavalry, 7th Cavalry, with Teddy Roosevelt, and we were talking one day, and he says, "There's going to be a war." He says, "You better do something about it." So we got out of the National Guards into the regular army, and we had it figured out that I would be over there and get my training and come back and be a drill sergeant in the United States. But my time was extended, and by the time the extension was over, where the Japs were all over that place, my enlistment ended up for over 6 years. First one, I wasn't sure of my health. I weighed 89 pounds when I got back, so I enlisted and was sent to finance school and did finance work at Hamblin Field until I got discharged in 1948.
Let me pull you out of the Second World War and let me bring you in to today, since I have four of you here all at the same time. And a question I haven't asked at this junction is, you know, we're back in another war, although our complement isn't millions in the field. We've got 150,000 men and women overseas right now. And we've lost over the past 2 years 1,500 people. And you understand what service and sacrifice means. But what are your feelings about the American public today who say we shouldn't be in any kind of conflict like this?
I'll say my piece on that. It was a thing that worked itself out through time and in history. We were sitting here taking sides with the Israelis, which I think is good, because they needed a place to be, and the Arabs begin to hate us like they did them. They attack us with, as everybody knows, by hitting the Twin Towers. And I think we needed to do something to retaliate, because if you don't, any sign of kindness to people who've never lived outside this country, any piece of kindness is always considered a weakness by the rest of the world. So the Arabs, of course, they don't like us. And rather than fight them on our homeland, we have never had to do that to anybody. Then we need to be fighting them over there, and we need to kill as many of them as we can, because there's only one protection against a man who would kill himself just to kill you, and that's to kill him first. And that's not our heritage at all. We do not believe in that. But we're going to get to where we do, unfortunately, and we're going to have to get down on their level before we can ever get them under control. That's my piece on it.
I think we should stay out of it. They come over here, I fight them, but I don't think we should go over there and get into it.
I think that the big mistake was in joining the UN. I think we should never have been in the UN, and I think the UN is, and its one world government, is detriment to the whole world. I think that Bush went against the wishes of all of them, and I think that he was right in it to a certain point, but I think that it's going to be another Korea, really, because these people have been fighting for years among themselves.
That's right.
That's all they know. And any man that'll give his life for such as they do, there's no way of defeating them, but John says to get them first.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I may disagree with some people, or they didn't disagree with me, but we had to do something. We couldn't sit here with that. We had to come up with something. And I think Bush is doing the best of his ability. And we, if you look back, we hadn't lost very many people over there. Now, look how many people we lost coming back in and taking the Philippines. 9,000 approximately offhand, maybe a little more. And we had to do something. We can't say, well, they won't do it again. They'll attack us. And I don't know whether this is going to stop it or not. But I don't think we will ever tell those people what type of government they're going to have and do. And our type of government is not the same. Is not good for the whole world, I don't guess. But they said, oh, well, they worship one God and we worship one God. Well, what difference would it change the name of that God or not? But we're in a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to do, nobody knows what's best.
Maybe that's an issue, too. The average soldier is always caught somewhere between the front line and the home front politics. And as veterans, do you still think that the military, especially our military, is the last best hope for freedom in not only in our country but the rest of the world? Or has that posture changed in your mind?
Well, their attitude has changed. If they had a military like we did, where they knew they had to get down and dirty and get the job done instead of pussyfooting around with people who get embarrassed in prison and trying people for murder, utterly ridiculous. We have to get an army together that's going to be a fighting army, and they're going to have to be forgiven a lot of sins in order to get it solved. But I believe that they can eventually get them to where they're going to be afraid to attack us as they are the Israelis.
I think that you can't mix the military and politics. That's what ruined us in Korea, and that's what's going to ruin us here unless we get the politics out of it and let the military do what it has to do. I don't see how they expect to keep military men serving when they, like this fellow that was tried for shooting a guy that was wounded, who may have very well had a grenade in his hand, and all this. As long as this stuff goes on, you're going to have great trouble getting people to fight.
And you all catch me at dinner Saturday, because I flew back with a young Marine a few weeks ago who served with that young man. He was at Abu Ghraib camp, not the prison, but he was a serviceman in the camp. And there's a whole nother story about that, which maybe something we ought to talk about. Do you think, and legitimately, your campaign was a different bailiwick, but the theaters in general, do you think we would have been as successful during our war experience during the Second World War if we had had to deal with the media as it's configured today?
Absolutely not.
No.
The people at home need to be protected. They don't need to necessarily know how they're being protected. They just need to feel safe about it and let the military do its job.
I don't think they should allow that news media in there to start out with. And why they would let a person take a picture of some of that stuff, the people have done a about face or something in World War II. If we'd had something like going, that man would have never got away with a woman taking those pictures and showing it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody. You ought to shoot the photographer. That's right.
That, in my estimate, that's a no-no. That shouldn't have happened. Well, in the first place, I think maybe they went too far in part of the case that individual might have. But that shouldn't have been taken.
They have to realize that these people aren't like us, because they train their kids from a very young age to walk into a group with a bomb on them or something. The women are no different than the men if they decide to be a suicide person. So it's not like dealing with people that believe like we believe. They have an entirely different belief.
They've been fighting over there for a million years, and you're not going to stop them.
Let's go back to your experiences at this point. Was everyone who is part of ADBC, were you all prisoners of war?
All ADBC?
Yes, almost all.
All of us at that point.
Yeah,
there was a few submarine men.
A few submarines got out.
A few nurses.
We flew MacArthur and his group out from our air base.
We loaded it.
And including my commanding officer. he flew out because he was a West Pointer, and they were very scarce.
Okay.
And just a few personnel that could be members of the organization by not having been captured, but were defending the Philippines.
Can somebody solve for me whether MacArthur took off from the South Dock or the North Dock? There seems to be some confusion there.
He loaded his wife over on, it's the Seaman Cove, right across from the North Dock over on the 10. And then MacArthur and them, they took off from the North Dock.
North Dock.
I wasn't at the North Dock. I was over at the Seaman Cove, and his wife and kid was loaded over there, I think on the 38 boat. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But there was six of them PT boats, and we loaded them up, put 55-gallon drums of fuel on the stern of the boat, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, because that's good to hear, because the historical record usually says, or at least the official documents, say the South, but the men that I've talked to who've been on site say the North. And the other story I heard was, as MacArthur's going out, some kid on a searchlight lit him up, and somebody grabbed him and said, "Damn fool, turn that light off," so they don't see him going out.
Wife and them, MacArthur's wife and kid loaded up over at the Seaman Cove. There was a place.
Well, the general consensus is that he went to Australia by PT boat.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't have been possible.
That wouldn't have been possible.
He went down on a B-17 that was loaded in our airbase.
He went down to Mananao and loaded on B-17.
That's right. I served and a guard over his quarters in the machine gun pit in the pineapple field while he was there. And he and Kazan and there onto Rogers came in there and flew out together about the second night.
Okay.
And the first B-17 that was one in for him, he said that wasn't in shape for him to fly in, and they had to bring in a whole different B-17 before he would fly. And they loaded that plane with a bunch of crap when they could have taken mechanics and things that could have been used later. And as far as I'm concerned, MacArthur was a, I won't say the word.
Well, let me see.
A poor general. I can go right down the line and give you mistakes that he made and never won. The first one was with not letting us take off our planes to bomb Okinawa. We didn't know it at the time, but I have flown over Okinawa with General Maitland, and we knew where it was. And had we gotten permission from Sutherland was the one that cut everything off, but if we had have flown over Formosa, we'd have caught them on the ground because it was a ground fog, and this whole war would have been a different picture. And comes Bataan. He sends all of the men to Bataan, lets a bunch of Filipino civilians in, and he leaves the food on the docks in Manila for the Japs.
On December the 29th, we were laying out in Manila Bay when they bombed Corregidor, first time. And them planes came over at 3,000 feet, and our 3-inch 50s would only reach 21. And they just flew underneath that plaque. And I was most disappointed boy there ever was. I thought sure all them batteries had 5-inch 38s that was on ships. They didn't.
And you were still using powder. You were still using time fuses, right?
What?
Right. Yeah, you weren't using powder fuses at that point.
No.
Let me, and I'm taking a little different tack with you guys, because as we've got an awful lot of information, like we said, on confinement and conditions and the POW experience, and so much shrift has been given to the European POW experience. We see very little of it, although there's some things coming out recently about the Pacific Theater. But let's talk about what this experience has meant to you in terms of how you feel it impacted your later life into the future. I mean, it's one thing to imagine the chaos that goes on in a situation like that. It's another thing to know exactly what must go through someone's mind when they're confined for a long period of time. What does that do for you as a human being? Is there an upside to this? Is there a positive experience?
Yes, there is an upside to it, because you appreciate life a lot more. You appreciate America and freedom more than anything.
Our freedom.
That is the most important thing, and the most important gift that you have ever had as an American is your freedom. And never forget it.
one of the greatest things that bothered me when we come back, you know, the people didn't honor prisoners of war. He was dirt. And that, I felt that way. I know I went to the hospital, and the first thing they did is give me a Wasserman and a contest for my blood test, and I showed up with 4+ syphilis. And that's a hell of a shock after going through what we went through. And then they come back the next day and put me in isolation and come back the next day and said it was a mistake that malaria showed up in the con.
It's one of the mistake
tests.
You like.
And even though it's the worst of two worlds.
Well, with me, a general I was had a little visit with. In fact, I'd made a little talk in front of his, he was charged with this base. And he asked me the question, what three things you think contributed to a man surviving that? I said, well, I hadn't given it much thought, and I had to think about it. And I said, well, I'll tell you what I think about it. I think faith in God.
That's
a sense of humor and friends. You put those three together, and you can survive almost anything. And that's the same three, in my estimation, we need here in civilian life. There would have been no way, I think, that you could survive what we went through if you hadn't had some friends.
I blame MacArthur. MacArthur made agreement with the guys from Nanasan Ichi, which was a 731 detail that was in Manchuria, with all the lecturing they did on people, which they call logs, to find out how long you could live with your guts cut out and all this stuff. And he gave all those guys freedom. They never even went through the trials. He said if they turn the information over to the United States, why, he would pardon all those guys, which he did.
But personally for you, I mean, what was the upside of the experience? I mean, how does this enlarge you as a human being?
It definitely proved to me that freedom isn't free. And I have never forgiven the government for not taking care of us when we came back. They just turned us loose. A lot of guys got discharged that should have been hospitalized and all. And they had a chance to experiment and find out how starvation and all affected people on us. They never did a thing with us. Mm-hmm. Never used it at all.
And maybe I'm becoming more political than I need to be, but I still think this is part of the record that needs to be told. The Japanese have never paid reparations to the U.S. while they have paid reparations to all the other nation states that were combatants at that point. What's your take on that?
Well, there again, I blame our own government. Colin Powell says we're not entitled to it, but yet he tries to get compensation for the ancestors of the people whose ancestors were slaves. But us as prisoners are not entitled to a payment.
Answer that.
Okay. You ask a question there. That's a very good answer. Needs a good answer.
I think the first thing is what Mike Arthur said. To get that other information from 731, they say it's a reason he gave all that the ability for us to sue him and everything.
Can I clarify that when you say 731, is that legislation that...
731 is Nanasan Ichi, which is the detachment of people in Manchuria. They had these big hospital where they were developing plague and everything else, and giving plague to the rats, and then dumping rats and fleas and everything else with different diseases to see how it affected the natives in that area.
And you know, the salvage that's been done on the little sub outside of Pearl, that they have dredged up some scrap that was biologicals on that sub.
Yeah.
So the attitude was, if they could have made a landfall, they could have dropped that.
World-renowned law scholars say that it is not in there.
It isn't.
They have many holes in it. We've been fighting for several years. Mm-hmm. We've had some expensive law firms on it. And the scholars from around the world, they've gotten them together on signings of agreements. And they said it is absolutely not in there, that they wouldn't pay reparations to us, because there's many, many holes in that peace treaty. But the State Department is dead set against us ever getting 10 cents.
Does anybody have an opinion on why you think they are?
Japan is so powerful. They own so much of America.
I think the thing that first caused it was because they wanted them for an ally, because they were afraid we were going to have to take on Russia.
Let me ask each of you, as far as your internment was concerned, what are the primary images that you take from that? When you're quiet with yourself now, these many years after the fact, and you think back to those days, what's the thing that still keeps bobbing up in your memory more than anything?
The cruelty on the hell ships. That was the worst treatment that you could have. They stuck more men in those holes than could, to where they couldn't even lay down. Then they closed the hatch in the Manila when the heat was over 100 in those damn holes and guys were suffocating. No water, no food. First 3 days was put on that boat. Why, there was no food or water at all.
Almost as bad as what he said about the ship. And it was, I don't see how any of us survived. But when they loaded us in them boxcars and put 100 in that little lab, and every man had to stand up, and no telling how, and they closed the doors, and a little vent down here and a little bit back down there, and that heat, and was in there for hours. The men, several of them, you would die in these things, and you couldn't even, after you're dead, you couldn't even fall down. You were standing up. Only it didn't last as long.
I didn't make that experience because I was in Mindanao.
It was equal to the ship thing, only it didn't last for a few hours.
Ted?
Well, going to Japan, that ship locked down the hole for 62 days is a rough deal. Everything in Japan, as far as I'm concerned, is rough, getting beat. And when I went to Japan, I had an armband on my arm. I was blind this one eye, and they weren't supposed to take me in the mine. The first thing I ended up in the coal mine. I got in trouble down there, and they sent me over to Stevedore on the railroad dock at Fukuoka, camp number one. That's where I got liberated from.
Okay, let me make a comment there. The biggest problem that I've seen with the prisoners who survived is forgiving the Japanese. Now, the Lord's Prayer says, forgive our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And if you don't forgive the Japanese, you won't be forgiven. It's hard to do. I fought it for years and years. And the people who haven't forgiven until this day are not with us. They're long gone. They died years and years ago because this was a hate.
I don't think you'll ever forgive
them. This was a hate that was built up in them they could not expel anywhere. The only way you can expel it is to forgive them and say, let us move on.